Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Support for the morning show also comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Build a career as a licensed professional counselor and mental health and wellness advocate with the new Master's in Mental Health and Counseling from Parkside. Visit uwp.edu for more information. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And that dramatic music comes from the overture to Mozart's Don Giovanni, one of the great successes of Mozart's career. The premiere of Don Giovanni in Prague in 1787 was one of the great triumphs of his career. And Don Giovanni is about to be performed at Carthage in performances Friday night and Saturday afternoon. And I'm pleased to be standing in Siebert Chapel, where the production, where the performances will take place, with the two gentlemen who have helped to put this production onto the stage. Matt Barresi will be familiar to many of you. He's been on the morning show quite a number of times, and for a number of years, I don't even know how many years now, he's been the stage director for Carthage's operatic productions. Because he now has a full-time position elsewhere from Carthage, his presence here is a little more fleeting, so we have brought in Tommy Novak, a relatively recent Carthage grad, very busy professional actor in the area and very fine director, who has been assisting Matt. And so between the two of them, this production is taking place and taking shape, and we look forward to sharing it with the public this weekend. And after a rehearsal here in Siebert tonight, I appreciate them taking a little bit of time before they head home to talk about Don Giovanni and the experience of putting this production together. Mm-hmm. Matt Barresi, Tommy Novak, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Tommy Novak, I should mention, was on the morning show one time before when he helped preside over a wonderful summertime performance of Peter Pan. Peter Pan Jr., featuring a talented cast of youngsters from China. And so we had a great conversation about that. So Matt Barresi, first of all, put into perspective Don Giovanni. Just how great an opera are we talking about? What makes it great and what makes it a challenge that you relish?
Sure. It is one of the great operas. It is arguably the great opera. I mean, that case could certainly be made. It is tricky because tonally it has a lot of breadth. There are dramatic moments, there are heartbreaking moments, there are supernatural moments, there are horror moments, and there's a lot of comedy, a lot of buffa comedy as well. I believe it was called in the original folio a drama jocosa, a jocular drama, which is its own designation. And Mozart and de Ponte were masters of their craft at this point and were able to, Mozart in all his collaborations with Lorenzo de Ponte, was able to elevate the sort of wacky, farcical form of opera buffa into the sublime moments of truth and dignity and deep, you know, emotional experiences. And de Ponte really knew the craft of operatic stage work and could give beautiful dramatic poetry, but then click right into traditional Italian buffoonery. they make it work, but as a director, I think it is tricky to not get in their way. I mean, to massage those tones when it goes from Don Giovanni's servant Leporello doing some traditional comedy like you might see in a Commedia dell'arte to some soaring rage aria by the spurned Donna Elvira or the tragic Donna Anna, to do those at a breakneck pace, it is very tricky. And so it was a pleasure for me to work with the students and teach them some of the idiomatic things about acting in an opera, but it was wonderful for Tommy to be with them regularly and help them find the depth of these very well-drawn characters.
Have you directed Don Giovanni before?
I've done scenes from Don Giovanni. I've done much of Don Giovanni, but I've never done it all in a row like this, which was a real pleasure. In 2007, I had an off-Broadway show called Going Down Swinging, and it was a musical. It was a play with music adapted from Don Giovanni, set in a radio show in the mid to late 50s, the end of radio, with Don Giovanni as this Lothario entertainer, sort of Frank Sinatra type. And it was very well received, and the songs were jazz standard kind of songs inspired by Mozart's score, and the script very much followed the beats of De Ponte. So I've done a lot of kind of scholarly work diving into Don Giovanni, but I've never gotten to just stage the whole Megillah like this.
Yeah, well, cool. Tommy Novak, your background is, of course, straight theater and musical theater. So in terms of opera, you are a relative newcomer, not that you haven't had exposure to opera and thought about opera and know something about opera, but mostly you're coming at this as a theater person into the realm of opera. Can you just say a word about what it's been like to kind of delve into what I assume is your first big opera assignment and to work with students who are primarily opera singers? What's been like to have this experience and to work with them?
It's been really fun. What I really enjoy about it is that, like, the thing that differentiates opera from, like, a musical from, like, a straight play is that, like, the score tells you everything, including in musical theater, but, like, in opera, it tells you everything. So, like, a beat that would normally take 2 or 3 seconds in a straight play would take maybe a minute or so or 30 seconds in a musical might take 2 minutes in an opera. And it's like, how do you sustain those acting choices, and how do you navigate those acting choices and finding tactic while you're still staying in the same moment, singing the same thing over and over again? And that's been fun and interesting to, like, learn from Matt and learn from the students of how, like, how to navigate that versus, but also finding the truth and core of the dramatic arc from a play standpoint. Like, when Donna Elvira comes in and she's been scorned and left at the altar, like, what does that look like and how does it resonate in the body versus how she's singing it and what's going on underneath her in the score, and how to marry all three of those things has been really fun and interesting and really exciting, actually.
We should probably spell out for people that this is going to be a non-conventional Don Giovanni in a couple of different ways. One of them is this framework that has been created that was mostly a concept created by Tommy, which involves several sort of extra characters who kind of serve as almost narrators helping to guide us through. Who wants to describe what that framework is?
Let me tell you why the framework exists, and then I think Tommy can explain the framework itself. These are students in a BA program in an opera workshop setting. So there are not infinite rehearsal hours, and this is a monster show. It's very, very challenging. It's very long. To do it without any cuts, and over the course of the couple of hundreds of years of the show's history, it had two premieres in Europe in different cities with different songs. And the 20th century and 21st century way of doing these Mozart shows is to take every song that was ever assigned to it and do them all in a row. So these shows have gotten very long, and there's a very finite amount of brain space for these full-time students and rehearsal time. So it necessitated some cuts and some craft work, which Tommy and you, Maestro, handled very well. So I'll let you guys explain that.
So we came up with the idea that the play starts at the end where, spoiler alert, Don Giovanni gets dragged to hell by an ethereal character. And it starts there, and they get intersected by this group of angels who are curious on why he's being dragged to hell and what's the cause of why he's being doomed. Because you can go one place, especially you can go to two places, heaven or hell, and why you can go there. And so in order to, like, show snippets, the angels sort of are the judges on whether or not he should be sent downward or should be sent upward, based on his already fate. Mm-hmm. And so we start at the end and then go back to the beginning and sort of see what led us to this pivotal point, whether or not he's going to continue on his journey further downward or further upward.
Right. So the opera itself is performed as for these three angels, for them to see what in the world Don Giovanni has done to necessitate this sentence to hell, and by the end, of course, everybody agrees that's exactly what he deserves, and that's what you get.
Yeah, the OCA title of this piece, all pieces in this era had two titles, and it was called Don Giovanni OCA, the Libertine Punished in Italian. So you see a man who's become completely dissolute and unrepentant, and you wonder if he will repent or not. Now you don't wonder, because this is at least a 400-year-old myth, the Don Juan myth, and a 200-year-old opera. So you know that a statue is going to pull the man to hell at the end. It wouldn't be Don Giovanni if you didn't. So to examine it this way provides a different microscope over the process of his dissolution.
We should also mention that that we're doing it in kind of split format, Act 1 as fully staged, and then Act 2 in something that's more like, if you ever go see an opera done at the Milwaukee Symphony or down at Ravinia in semi-staged concert format instead. They'll still be in costume, but they'll just be, for the most part, standing relatively stationary but interacting. And that was done also for a kind of a concession to the limits of time within this workshop situation and the fact that they're singing this in Italian. I mean, it just... they can do the whole thing better if we do it in this way. Mm-hmm. But Matt, I think you had an interesting observation about how valuable an experience it actually is for the singers to have to work a big part of this piece in that kind of format and learn to be theatrical even within the limitations.
Yeah, and traditionally, I mean, the way this is staged, Don Giovanni always kind of exists in a limbo. Like, you're never really sure what building they're in or if they're in the street. They kind of wander around in this area. It's a character study. I mean, these are psychological portraits of people, and not a ton of care is given to literally where they are at any given moment. And this form has these long stretto moments that are park and bark. The characters come out, they stand in a line, and they sing what they are feeling towards the audience. And the music moves and is glorious, so it's not stultifying in any way. This has a lot of action, and you will see sword fights and some pretty big action items, some seductions, some dances in the portions that are fully staged. But for the actors to stand and deliver and find the emotional depth of these characters and the nuances and the word delivery and the subtleties of character that you find in your posture and in your spine without running all about the stage at this stage in their development has a lot of value for them.
Matt, we should say that, and I think I touched on the introduction, that you aren't here at Carthage quite like you used to be because you have a really exciting full-time job now down in Illinois that keeps you there 5 days a week. But I was really anxious for you to still be part of this production because of the seniors, especially, who have worked with you any number of times in previous operas. And I just hated the thought of our seniors not having one more opportunity to work with you. Just say a quick word about what this full-time position is, which involves working with younger people, and then what it feels like then to get to come back and work with college students again, albeit in a limited basis.
Yeah, I'm at Lake Forest Academy, which is a beautiful, beautiful private school in Lake Forest, Illinois. It's a half boarding school, half day school, and it has a huge international community. So some of the students are what you'd think of as theater kids, but it's very much a liberal arts kind of high school. Everyone is trying a lot of things, and people from different cultures are trying things. So I direct the plays and the musicals there, teach acting classes, playwriting classes. And it's inspiring to see the lights come on in people that age, and to see people make cross-cultural discoveries and just make artistic discoveries and say, oh, I'm really enjoying the craft of the performing arts. When you get to up here, and particularly with the students in this opera program, most of which I've worked with for years. I think I've been, it may be 11 years that I've been staging things here.
Could be.
And a lot of this cast has been, has a lot of opera workshops under their belt. So this isn't about, oh, look, they've learned to love opera. These kids are living and breathing opera for about 25 hours a day. But then you get to take it to the next level and do kind of a deep dive into their experience with opera and their ability to take these cultural artifacts that are almost holy. I mean, these characters are part and parcel with Western culture's fabric, and watch them make it animate and find the freshness in it. And that is really a blessing. It's really a pleasure. Hmm.
Tommy, what has it felt like for you? As we said earlier, you actually come in a sense from other spheres, which has been so valuable. I mean, I think all the students would agree that, you know, you've brought something very valuable to the table in terms of probably stretching them and sharing insights with them that are, you know, for the most part, pretty new to them, even though they are a lot of them experienced and capable singers on the opera stage, at least. What has this been like for you in terms of working with most of these students for the first time?
It's been fun, and just, you know, like anytime, like I feel like anytime you're working with somebody new, there's always like a test of boundaries of like where and what and how far we can push somebody, because you don't know how far they've come and what's been comfortable for them and what's like completely out of the box for them, because it all just seems out of the box for me. But one of the fun things has been just exploring physicality mostly and giving them a wealth of a toolbox to tap into, to find ways of like developing character from a physical standpoint, because I work a lot with dance and do a lot of movement based acting exercises and things like that, and teach that. And it's been really fun to like have them try something, and then they're like, well, that might not be what my character does. I was like, well, let's just try something and make a choice and make a physical gesture, make something bold. And then we'll see if it sticks or not. And like to get them to think, and already seeing them from first semester into this semester working on this piece, you can see them calculating, oh, well, I gotta make a choice here because I can't just stand here and be dead behind the eyes. Like I have to find some way to connect character to physicality. And there are some times where you have to stand there, but like what activates you standing there, and how do you ground yourself? And it's just been fun. I did, like, it's been really fun to just like, let's just try. Can we just try this? Let's just try this. Let's just try this.
Playing.
Yeah, just playing, like literally playing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's been valuable. It's been fun to see them grow in so many ways. Matt, a last question. Mm-hmm. How would you rate just the sheer talent of this group of people? I mean, for people who have come to see operas here in the recent past at Carthage.
I think, I mentioned tonight to the cast, because we just finished a rehearsal, that there was more connection to the text with this group than I think we've seen in recent memory, probably ever. They are singing it largely in Italian, with the exception of the interstitials, and they know what they are singing. And you say, well, of course they have. They must know what they're singing. But these are not Italians. and there's a lot of material here. And the difference between kind of knowing the gist of what you're singing and knowing the words that are actually coming out of your mouth and what the nuance there and how that reads on your face and how that reads in your gestures and your interactions is a big difference. I think everyone who comes to the shows here are always pleasantly surprised that a small Midwestern liberal arts college has as big a voices as we have. And then I think you'll see some smart massaging of the material in this one as well. So if you've seen things before and enjoyed them, I think there's a value added. If you've never been here to see this, something very special going on right next to the lake. And if you are a music and music theater and opera lover, it's right here, and you should really check it out. Mm.
Mozart's Don Giovanni will be performed Friday night and Saturday afternoon. And Matt Barresi and Tommy Novak, thank you for all your hard work on this production, and thanks for being part of the morning show.
Thanks.
The performances of Mozart's Don Giovanni are going to be Friday evening at 7:30 and Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock
in Carthage's Siebert Chapel. The performances are free and open to the public. The time is 8:30. Part two of today's morning show is coming up in just a moment. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. We have all certainly been on the receiving end of hurtful words. And if anything, we are experiencing that even more, given the times in which we live, divisive times, of course, for our country. And it seems that often when people are talking about maybe difficult topics or for whatever reason, we seem to be especially good at lashing out with words that can cut very deeply and inflict a lot of pain. And sometimes, of course, it doesn't need to be a political squabble or anything around sort of momentous, weighty issues. Sometimes it is over personal slights or and something that emerges out of a misunderstanding that can lead to really unfortunate, painful things being said. What do we do when somebody has spoken to us or about us in a way that causes us pain? How do we move beyond it? Janelle Reardon has written a book on this topic called Overcoming Hurtful Words, Rewrite Your Own Story. She is a speaker and author and relationship expert and life coach from a Christian perspective, as a matter of fact. And in this book, she seeks to give us some strategies that can help help somebody move beyond what has maybe been a very, very painful, hurtful exchange. And we're going to be speaking with her for the next few minutes about her work and about this book again called Overcoming Hurtful Words, which is published by Worthy Inspired. Janelle Reardon, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Oh, thank you, Greg. It is an honor to be on your show.
I'm glad we can have this this conversation. What, if anything in particular, prompted you to explore this particular topic to such length?
Very personal, obviously. It was first and foremost to dig into this whole emotional, relational trauma subject. There was a tipping point with a female leader, but it really was a tipping point, Greg. As I reflected back, I come from the home of an alcoholic father. My husband does as well. And so there was certainly a life long history within my own personal family of origins of hurtful words and actions from people that, you know, are supposed to be your safe people. And so I think that it's really been an ongoing process in my life. I can reflect back to being, you know, 6, 7, 10 years old and going, there's just something not quite right here. So I think I've been, I was born into the world very sensitive, very intuitive, very empathic. So I think it has truly been a lifelong journey of understanding the power of our words. Words have always been very, very important to me. Maybe that's just what my whole entire purpose in life, as I look back now over, you know, half a century. So I think it became for me a lifelong process that then hit a tipping point where I just, boy, it was an emotional traumatic crisis, and I thought, I can't live this way anymore. I need to make some changes, and change begins within my own heart. And so as a teacher, as a counselor, I began to research, and that's what I did. And it led me to this new program, this new whole new platform on which I will stand till the day I die.
A couple things I want to ask you of kind of overarching fashion. One of them is and I think it's important to say this, that because this is a public radio station, it's actually not often that that I deal with books that are quite explicitly sort of Christian in their focus, although I happen to be a Christian and my Christian faith is very important to me, but that's typically not what this program can or really should be about. However, in this case, I really felt like this was a book that had some very important things to say, potentially even to somebody who maybe comes from a different faith tradition or potentially even without any faith tradition whatsoever. But I think you are talking about something very, very important and something that potentially could make a difference, whether or not somebody happens to have the same background of faith that you do. I'm just curious if you thought about that at all as you wrote this book, hoping that it would not only be a helpful book for your own fellow believers, but would even have something to offer somebody else.
Oh, you just hit the nail on the head, Greg. It was actually a tension, my whole process of writing, because it really is a topic that extends the realm of what we would call organized religion. It is a tenet in living a meaningful life, a rich, rewarding life. It's a book that deals with civility and integrity and reaches beyond the realm of faith. I just so happen to adhere to the Judeo-Christian worldview. So, I do speak of God. I talk about Jesus, and I see that as an ancient text that I adhere to and I believe in wholeheartedly. But the subject, as in my practice, my private practice, totally speaks to every human being at the core level. So it definitely reaches beyond the faith realm, and I sure pray that it does. Because not only does our nation need this message, the world needs this message. Right. We have somewhere forgotten the practice of discretion, the practice of civility, the practice of just being empathic human beings.
Right. I quite agree. You also, at some point early on in the book, make mention of how a lot of this book springs not only out of your own understanding and experience, but also from having spoken with many, many women. And the thing I want to ask you about is that matter of women versus men. And to what extent this book really is written for women and about women, or is this something in which you think women experience this in a way different from the way men experience this? Help us understand that divide, particularly in terms of what you were thinking, how you framed this in your own mind as you wrote this book. Is this a book, in a sense, only for women?
No. I will definitely explain my tenet for this. In my private practice, in not only my private practice, but then in my speaking and lecturing, and it tended to be women waiting around to talk, women standing in line. In my practice, working with marital couples, it ended up totally being the woman was more the heartbeat, the heart, bearing the burden for the family, in the sense that we are typically the more emotional, more sensitive, more empathic, not on the whole, but typically. And so for the purpose of this book, I felt like I think the woman truly is the heart of the home. And, you know, the old adage that the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world, right? We are the child bearers. We are the ones that create that initial deep, intimate bond with children in the womb. So it does come, I'm a woman, it comes from that perspective, speaking to the heart of a woman. But, and women truly are the readers, you know, statistically in the family. And so it is definitely not just for women. And maybe we can expand this as we move into the next book and the next book. I totally would love to have a family book and a whole family curriculum on how to do this as a family. But, yeah, so Ernest's answer is just narrow the focus of this particular book to speak to the woman, and then hopefully it'll go and expand from there.
Right. You talk in the book about some terms that I'm pretty sure you have coined that all relate to the word heart, the human heart. And in particular, you talk about the heart rift and the heart sift and the heart lift, the heart and the heart shift. And it's very, yeah. And it's really interesting to think about all of that. Of course, all of this really begins with when someone has suffered what you call a heart rift. Explain typically how a heart rift is sort of suffered, or how a heart rift is inflicted on someone, and what it typically feels like.
Typically feels like an emotional earthquake. I write in Overcoming Hurtful Words how here in Virginia we, one August afternoon, experienced an earthquake. Now that's the East Coast. We don't experience earthquakes here. And it was about, the epicenter was about 150 miles from my home. And, you know, it just rattles and shakes everything. So kind of working on that metaphor of earthquake physically, that emotionally we experience an earthquake when someone delivers shocking, harmful, hurtful, you know, often emotionally paralyzing words. We experience that deep layer within our heart where it causes a rift, you know, a little fracture. And for some of us, that starts early in our life, and then, you know, the rift just gets to a point where, you know, it just can't take anymore. So a heart rift is that first stage of the heartless method that you move through in the book. And it's just those deep wounds that are caused by those heartbreaking words. And typically, they're deeper when they come from a close, trusted friend or family member.
Right. I was just going to say, yeah, that the strangers can certainly inflict pain, but it is not the same as when somebody you love and trust has delivered.
People. Yeah.
So
yeah, it's really the same experience I felt sitting in my living room. I was actually taping a video series from my very first book in 2007, Rock Solid Families. I was taping a video series and an earthquake happened. So all of the book, Rock Solid, the tape, everything fell off the counter, and I was like, oh, my goodness. It comes that swiftly. Like, what just happened, you know?
Hmm.
And that's what first days reflect, what just happened. What on earth is going on here?
Right. And I suppose that's part of when we talk about the what you like to call the heart sift, where we take the time to kind of examine something, but in a way that is healthy.
This is all about the premise of this entire, hopefully this whole new movement that I'm hoping to start, is healthy and unhealthy. We really only have two choices of responding in life. Unhealthy is a reaction, healthy is a response. So yes, the heart shift, and I know you're moving into heart lift, but the heart shift part is just really where you sit and examine in a healthy way, perhaps with a counselor, a trained life coach. I'm hoping to raise up an army of heart lifters where you examine those rifts just long enough in a healthy way and vocalize that crushing pain so that you can put it to rest, you can make peace with it, so that you can move into future freedom. So it is a methodical, heartfelt approach where, just like you would sift flour, you're just going to go, okay, this happened to me. That's a marker on my life map. Now what do I do with it?
I think one of the things that's interesting about this bit of advice is that I think what is sometimes assumed by people is that the best thing somebody can do is try to put something behind them, try to forget about it.
Let it go.
Yeah, and sometimes they are advised to do that, and sometimes it's something we ourselves feel like we should do, because confronting something, thinking about something that has caused us great hurt, is often something that causes us, at least in the short term, a great deal of discomfort. But you are saying that this is a process that we simply cannot afford to avoid.
If, in fact, you want to move into true freedom. You know, I with my clients and in my own personal life, I see people stop just short of the finish line, right? It just gets to be too hard, too much work, and they stop. And so when that happens, you really stay stuck. I write, and in the next book, I hate to go to that one, but I'm writing a lot more about the let it go thing. But, you know, really, Greg, it's, do you want to be whole? Truly whole? And if, in fact, you do, then it's vital that you examine your history of hurts, is what I call it, with a healthy perspective so that you can move on. Now, obviously, there are deeper wounds than others, you know, and that's, I'm not saying that you're just going to move right along. It is going to be a process. I say over and over, this is not easy, but it's empowering, and I will walk with you through this. So we don't want to stop just short of the emotional freedom finish line. We want to do the work, and that's why we need a community around us of support that will help us move beyond and forward.
Could you say a word, please, about the three phases of what you call this heart lift journey of coming to terms with a hurt that we have experienced, the three phases of reflect, reframe, and reauthor?
Yes. So being a methodical person, I'm a very nuts and bolts human being and counselor and life coach. So I have always been the person who wants my clients to leave with a plan of action. So for me, it was like, okay, a heart lift is just the safe space where we vocalize our crushing pain, which is our history of hurts. We look at it long enough to deal and to look at the unhealthy in order to move forward into future freedom. So we do that in three phases. Reflect, as you said, is the heart rifting phase. We go, that's where the earthquake happens, and you go, holy cow, you're holding on to your chair. What just happened? And in my vernacular, my Judeo-Christian, I say, welcome God into the present pain. You know, that's the present pain. That hurts so bad. Oh, my goodness, what happened? All right, let's say outside the realm of faith, we can just say, welcome breath into that. Because breathing just means to gain composure. So I turn to God. I gain my composure there. Now, that's that Viktor Frankl says, between the stimulus and the response, there's a space. And that's a millisecond, usually. So, you know, a big initiative of this book is to train, you know, emotional health first responders. You know, so that we can go, okay, we're going to practice, and we're going to train everyone in our community to practice so that when these hurtful words happen, we know how to handle it. We move from what just happened to the reframe, which is the heart shift. That's where the heart goes, oh, and it awakens to truth. And in this reframing, you face the fault lines. You face those fault lines that have been shifting for years, those past hurts. And then with the help of your community or a healthy mentor or counselor or relational coach or trauma coach, you reauthor. It is a proven statistic, Greg, that when you make sense of your story, you can move into freedom. Just making sense of it. Just going, okay, let me look at this and let me just wrap my brain around growing up for me in an alcoholic home and the repercussions of that, so that I do not have to stay labeled as codependent or ACOA, et cetera, you fill in the blanks of your life, so that I can move into a meaningful, healthy life. So those three phases, that's how we move through it. And honestly, it leads to tremendous, tremendous freedom.
Mm. In building what at one point you call a new narrative that one builds for one's life.
Yeah.
in our last minute or two, I wanted you to at least touch on time flies as I wanted you to just touch briefly on something that you share in the book about a health crisis that you yourself experienced involving a condition I'd never heard of, but one that can affect the way someone swallows. So something as essential to life as that. It's intriguing that this is included in your book, but I'm glad that it's there. It's a very poignant part of your own personal story. Just at least touch on what I am talking about and explain how this experience has been important for you and important for your own journey.
Well, a very short story of a very long journey. I began to have cardiac feelings as though I was having a heart attack, and evolved into not being able to swallow. I couldn't even swallow water. So went through a battery of very long testing until I finally went to an expert GI doctor who put me through a test and found out I have this rare disease, esophageal disease called achalasia. It actually means failure to relax, which is kind of funny for a type A girl, but I couldn't swallow. And so I remember sitting in the office when he said, "You have achalasia. Write that down in that little notebook of yours. And by the end of this ordeal, Janelle, you're going to be an expert in swallowing." And I thought it was very interesting. So as I was going through the book, it wasn't my intention. But then when I got to looking up the word swallow, I saw that it meant one of the meanings is to suppress feelings. Well, I about fell off my chair. And when you look at it further, it can actually mean to resist something consciously. And behavioral scientists have come to see that repressors are people, you know, like myself, honestly. So the physical definitely related to my emotional state, where I, you know, I maintain a stiff upper lip under all circumstances. And they say that we're one of the most mystifying personality types. So people would always say, "Oh, Janelle, you're so strong, strong, strong. You're just the strongest person." Well, no, that's when I finally came to the end of my strength, is where I really became, you know, a new person and began to write my new narrative, because I couldn't physically swallow. I had to have an experimental surgery, the third in the state of Virginia, where they just cut open your lower sphincter, so now it's just open all the time. So, Greg, for me, it just paralleled, and I felt like it was so very, very important, because a lot of times when we suppress, we deny, we don't use our voice to respond in a healthy manner to this unhealthiness emotionally that's going on around us, that suppression is going to take a toll. And I see it happening every day. So if I can do anything through this book, through my time on this platform, this beautiful opportunity that I have been given, I hope to help people find their voice. And voice equates to me with value, worth, and dignity, so that when they are spoken to in a way that lacks discretion or unhealthiness, they can respond in a healthy manner. That's the whole my whole purpose. And so now I have a physical disease that constantly reminds me of this great emotional need that I see around me.
I like that very much. I don't like that you are dealing with this affliction, but I appreciate the fact in which you have made sense of it and in a sense made it a teachable moment for yourself and, of course, for all of us as well. The book, again, is
we
Overcoming.
We have to do that, don't we?
Yes, absolutely. That's part of what it's all about. The book, again, is...
You've got to turn it around.
Yes. The book is Overcoming Hurtful Words, Rewrite Your Own Story, published by Worthy Inspired and the author, Janelle Reardon. Janelle Reardon, I have very much enjoyed this, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak with you about your very, very interesting book. Very best wishes to you, and thank you for your time.
You too, Greg. Blessings.
Tomorrow on the morning show, you'll be hearing my conversation with Neil Sharnick and a student at Carthage, Cassidy Scorcha, who are part of Carthage's production of Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods, which is opening this weekend and running for performances this weekend and the following weekend. Into the Woods, of course, is one of the really important masterpieces in the history of recent musical theater. And it's always an exciting event when any school or theatrical company undertakes it. So we'll be talking about it and playing a number of excerpts from it on tomorrow's morning show. On Thursday's morning show, it will be Dr. Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, who joins us once a month to offer his thoughts on various current events. And there'll be plenty to talk about, including the talks between the United States and North Korea and what might be ahead for that, and many, many other matters that we will explore. On Friday, you'll hear out of the archives my interview with the author of a book called Hello, Everybody. It's a really fascinating, discerning look at the earliest days of radio in this country. And radio is something that is very easy to take for granted, but when one reads this book, one has a real powerful sense of how American life was completely reshaped by the creation of radio and the way in which people could experience, really for the first time in their lives, the world from outside coming into your own living room. A very, very powerful experience indeed. It just so happens that we are rebroadcasting this conversation in conjunction with Wisconsin Public Radio's Spring Membership Drive. And speaking of not taking things for granted, it's important that you not take for granted all that you gain from listening to public radio broadcast. And if you are an appreciative listener of Wisconsin Public Radio, and especially if you are an appreciative listener to WGTD and all that we offer to you, we hope that you will take a moment and be part of Wisconsin Public Radio's Spring Membership Drive. If you are not a member, please become a member, and you can do so by going online to www.wpr.org, or you can call toll-free 1-888-202-2552. Again, the website, wpr.org, or the toll-free phone number, 888-202-2552. And thank you for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio. Again, a little taste of the overture to Mozart's Don Giovanni being performed this weekend at Carthage College, Friday night, 7:30, Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock in Siebert Chapel. The performances are free and open to the public. You're listening to WGTD HD.